The Ear to Asia podcast is made available on the Jakarta Post platform under agreement between the Jakarta Post and the University of Melbourne.
Hello, I'm Sami Shah. This is Ear to Asia.
The pinyin system, it's a fantastic system. If you know the rules, you have no trouble reading out a Chinese name that you see written down. The problem arises when people don't know what the rules are and simply apply a guess based on what the letter might stand for in English. Think about how much trouble most of us who are not Irish have with trying to work out how Irish names are said when we see them written down.
There needs to be a lot more recognition that the rich workplace culture, that different names and people from various cultural backgrounds come together to create a really productive, creative, and resilient workplace. And I think we need to feel positive about talking about and discovering and embracing diversity and find joy in learning about different traditions.
In this episode, navigating East Asian names in a Western world. Ear to Asia is the podcast from Asia Institute, the Asia research specialist at the University of Melbourne. For many people of East Asian background living in Western societies, the first barrier they encounter is their own name. A name mispronounced at school, overlooked in a job interview, or flattened into an easier form for colleagues' convenience. These moments may seem minor, but they accumulate, shaping a person's sense of identity and belonging. Some adopt Western names for professional settings. Others insist on their traditional names despite the corrections, and many navigate between the two depending on context. These struggles in the present are rooted in a much longer history. In Japan's Meiji period, for example, millions were suddenly required to adopt surnames. In Korea and Vietnam, colonial rule imposed new naming systems that disrupted local traditions. Across the region, Chinese characters spread naming conventions that linked identity to family lineage, social hierarchy, and cultural values. So, what does it mean when such historically rich naming practices collide with Western bureaucracies, classrooms, and workplaces? How do names reflect deeper questions of gender, hierarchy, and cultural belonging? And in our globalized world, what does true respect look like? Is it simply trying to pronounce names correctly, or something more? Joining us to discuss is Professor Ikuko Nakane, a language researcher in Japanese studies here at Asia Institute. She is also Associate Dean of Diversity and Inclusion for the University of Melbourne's Faculty of Arts. Also with us is Asia historian and lecturer Dr. Lewis Mayo from Asia Institute as well. Welcome back to Ear to Asia to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's start with a very basic question. Chinese characters spread across East Asia over centuries, becoming the foundation for naming systems in Korea, Vietnam, and Japan. How did this cultural transmission work, and what did it mean for local naming traditions? Lewis?
So the countries that we think of as being outside China that historically have used Chinese as their language of culture and which is registered in the presence of Chinese characters in their writing systems, that is Japan, Korea, and Vietnam. Those countries did not have indigenous systems of literacy, indigenous writing systems, prior to the spread of classical Chinese as a written language. So it's a little bit like the situation you would have when Latin moves into parts of Europe where there is no form for writing the local language. So that would happen, for example, in Poland or in the area we now think of as the Czech Republic, where the local languages are spoken but not written. So Latin becomes the language that the church uses. And that's the first place through which literacy kind of comes in. Now, in the case of Korea and of Vietnam and of Japan, the spread of classical Chinese, the equivalent of Latin, is slightly different in each case. So the Chinese script originates basically in the area that we now call the Yellow River Valley, probably around 3,000 years ago. And the Chinese characters, as we call them, are ways of writing down words in Chinese, essentially. And so that then becomes standardized as a written language, a rendering of Chinese spoken languages, which then moves across the whole cultural area that is the old heartland of Chinese culture and consolidates itself in a probably a 1,000-year period. And so Chinese characters are ways of writing Chinese words. That writing system then moves into areas where non-Chinese languages are spoken. As I say, it's a little bit like the situation with Latin moving into areas like Poland or Ireland, where, you know, languages unrelated to Latin are spoken, and then you get it used as a Latin is there as the language of culture first, and then its influences kind of carry on. So think about something like the Catholic Church, as it expands, takes with it names that are Catholic in association, like Paul, Mary, etc. And then those names, as conversion takes place, become the given names of Christian people in societies outside of those contexts. So as classical Chinese moves into these other areas, it takes with it the naming systems, which are focused on the surnames of Chinese. So Chinese names are surname first, followed by a given name, which is usually or frequently a two-syllable name. So let's take an example. Xi Jinping, right? The family name is Xi, and the given name is Jinping. So his father, Xi Zhongxun, the family name is Xi, the given name is Zhongxun. Okay. Now, surname first, given name second. That's the norm, for example, in Korea as well. So if you think of someone like Kim Jong-un, Kim is the surname, Jong-un is the given name. His father, Kim Jong-il, Kim is the surname, Jong-il is the given name. His grandfather, Kim Il-sung, Kim is the surname, Il-sung is the given name. So that is, the Korean names are all of Chinese derivation with Korean pronunciation. That also obtains in Vietnam. So Koreans and Vietnamese people have surnames of Chinese derivation. So names like Ho of Ho Chi Minh is from the Chinese surname Hu. If we think of some other examples, well-known Vietnamese people for an older generation, the Vo Nguyen Giáp, Vo Nguyen Giáp. So that's a Chinese surname originally Wu. Or the common Vietnamese surname Nguyen, Ngu. Y-E-N, one of the commonest names there, that's from a Chinese name, surname Ruan. Okay, so in Vietnam and in Korea, the structure of the names is borrowed directly from China. If you take Ikuko's name, Nakane Ikuko, Nakane is the surname. In Japan, that would come first, and Ikuko is the given name. Neither Nakane nor Ikuko are of Chinese derivation. Those are Japanese words, but they would be written with Chinese characters that are used for those purposes. Okay, so this is quite a complicated set of questions, as you can see, and that's the basic profile you get. As classical Chinese becomes the language of education, culture, and politics, it spreads its naming systems in the places that are not under the direct control of Chinese states, such as Vietnam and Korea. In Japan, classical Chinese comes in as the first language of culture and of education, but it doesn't displace the local surname and given name systems.
Staying within the historical context then, there's something fascinating about how Chinese surnames concentrated into about 100 names are shared by over a billion people today. What historical forces created this incredible concentration?
The idea that there are 100 surnames is a little exaggerated. It's probably in the region of several hundred, but it's a much smaller number of surnames than you would find in Japan, for example. The number of surnames that you find in Korea and in Vietnam, which are both cultures that have been influenced by the Chinese background, by Chinese cultural backgrounds, as I've explained, the number of surnames there is actually fewer than in China. So you have rare surnames in China, as well as a lot of very common ones. So names like Wang, W-A-N-G, or Wang in the Cantonese pronunciation, or Zhang, Z-H-A-N-G, or Li, all of those names are, the kind of core ones. Now, the reasons for why the names are so small in number are difficult to fully evaluate. There's an interaction between the surname being the organizing principle for a large family, and family continuity being something that is associated with continuing to commit yourself to your surname as the thing that creates the larger kind of clan group. The other thing is the question of the convenience of a centralized government. The government, we can argue, finds it easier to deal with a small number of surnames than a lot of surnames for the simple reason that it makes administration more straightforward. If you're having to only master a small number of names as a bureaucrat, you're having an easier time. Now, I mean, this, of course, is in itself illustrative of what we find here in Australia, where bureaucracy is one of the key points whereby name simplification and name change tends to occur. You end up with a name given to you by a passport control officer who hears your name and then makes it up. Well, in the case of perhaps of the traditional Chinese bureaucracy, the official comes in perhaps to an area where the surname system has not been fully consolidated and says, okay, you're all going to be Li. you're all going to be Wang. And this, of course, creates a, fairly manageable situation for a traditional administrator. So it is in part a story about centralized control by the state and also by families that have their own culture and identity who are themselves negotiating with that state. So it's a kind of fusion of the two elements. So that said, the number of surnames is very small. The number of given names is extremely varied. So you can find very, very rare given names, which are often a matter of poetic selection or selection for what is considered auspicious in terms of someone's astrological positioning. These are all considerations. You occasionally find given names that are there to ward off evil spirits, but those are much, much rarer, as having a name that's deliberately unattractive so that evil spirits won't take any interest in the child is something that you find, for example, in Mongolia, which is outside of this Chinese naming system. But, so there's a lot of creativity when it comes to given names.
Ekuko, when we look at pre-modern times in Korea, Japan, and Southeast Asia, surnames weren't always given to ordinary people. However, in 1875, Japan's Meiji period offers a fairly dramatic example of the government suddenly requiring all citizens to adopt surnames. What was that process like for millions of people who'd never had family names before?
In 1875, the government introduced this law that required people to select a surname. That is basically so that they can actually have everybody on the record. And then that actually meant that people who didn't really used to have a surname were suddenly faced with this situation where they thought that they might be actually charged a tax by selecting a surname and then put that on the record. So it was really a challenge for the government to get people on board with this process. And so, there was a lot of problems with the introduction of that law. So the government actually created another law that forced everybody to have family names and that had to be actioned. So now, yeah, everybody has a surname and a name. And that was really, you know, when Japan, basically during this Meiji Restoration period, it was a big modernization period after the long period of feudal system. So there was this really key system of family registry that was also introduced during this period. And then that is also, in a way, the government's effort to actually keep everybody on record in the form that they can actually have a good grasp of who the citizens are, where they are, what families are located where in Japan. And this system of family registry actually continues to date. And there is some argument that this is a form of state control over its citizens. And there are also interesting issues, for example, as to who can be part of the family registry, and then also spouses' choices to select whose surname that they're going to adopt when people get married. And this has been a fairly robust, big debate in recent years in Japan, whether couples can choose to have separate surnames or not. And that also is related to this larger issue of family registry system in Japan.
So one of the things you mentioned there, which is particularly interesting, is the state control aspect. To what extent do state requirements for surnames represent forms of bureaucratic control over populations?
Up until 1985, the Japanese government, when people who arrived from overseas wanted to naturalize as Japanese citizens, they required these people to select a Japanese, native Japanese name. Now, that also has changed, and people can now choose their preferred names associated with their country of origin, culture of origin. So that's also one way in which the state control is exercised in terms of a name selection as well. Surnames selection between spouses, basically, so while there's a lot of push towards separate surnames being allowed for couples, so basically, the statistics shows that women tend to choose their partner's surname more, while the legislation actually allows either of the spouse's names could be chosen for the family surname. So that's been causing a lot of debates in Japan. I think every time there's an election that comes up, and that becomes a big discussion point.
Louis, colonial periods have brought new pressures on traditional naming practices. How did French rule in Vietnam or Japan or occupation of Korea disrupt established ways of naming and addressing people?
Well, I think in the case of the surname system, French rule is not as disruptive as one might expect, because there was a state which was organized around a system of more or less universal registration of the population in the pre-French era, and that was an enormous boon to the incoming French regime, because they simply took over that structure and kept it in place. And it was, as I've said, itself a kind of product of the colonial history of Vietnam as a periphery of the Chinese imperial state, but also a periphery that detached itself from imperial control quite early on and maintained its own separate governance system. I guess whenever you see a situation in which surnames come first, encountering a system where surnames come second, there's a natural tendency to try to rework that so that you'll find a lot of people do what is normal for Japanese people overseas, such as Ikuko, which is to adopt the position of having the normal situation is to be called Ikuko Nakane as a way of convenience, providing convenience for people who are not familiar with a different surname order. And I guess you might find people in Vietnam adopting a French given name and then using their Vietnamese surname. But it's fairly clear that in the case of prominent political leaders such as Ho Chi Minh or any of the other Lee Duc Tho, any of the people well known in the Vietnamese resistance movement to the French, they were always presented in their using their traditional surname first, given name second order. In the case of Korea, what you have is Japanese colonial rule, and this was also true because Taiwan was a Japanese colony in Taiwan as well, where at a certain point, the Japanese administration wants to bring a population that uses or populations that use Chinese style surname and given name practices, whether in a Chinese form in or a Sinitic form in Taiwan or in a Korean form in Korea, the Japanese government decided at certain stages to try to Japanize those populations by obliging them to acquire Japanese surnames and given names and to dispense with their Chinese names. Now, this is often seen as a mark of cultural violence by the Japanese colonial state. So we're talking about the period between 1895 and 1945 in Taiwan and 1910 and 1945 in Korea. So these attempts to Japanize the populations there produce complex responses. On the one hand, people can say, well, you know, I feel as though adopting a Japanese name makes me equal with the other members of the Japanese Empire. This view is, you know, found in some parts of the system. And on the other hand, it's I must resist this colonization by insisting on my own name. Now, this is particularly complex in Korea because, of course, there are, you know, few survivals of the pre-Chinese naming system in the Korean structure. So in effect, if you're resisting colonization by insisting on your local naming practices, what you are in effect doing is affirming an older set of external colonizing cultural practices based on a Chinese model that becomes, in a sense, the basis for one's own name identity.
Ikuko, Japanese language forces speakers to choose honorifics like san and sama or kun every time they address someone. How does this grammatical requirement shape social interactions in ways that might surprise speakers of other languages?
Yeah, I think, you know, maybe this is, I have to start by mentioning that this is not really limited to Asian languages. In Australia, for example, people might say honourable or your honourable, I think. There are all these. Well, we also have titles such as professor, doctor, all these things as well. And then also when it comes to pronouns, European languages like French also make distinctions between, you know, polite vous and informal tu, for you, for example. And of course, in Japanese, there are lots of different ways that you can express the second person pronoun you as well. And then those things actually send social messages about positioning. in human relationships. And of course, you're not dictated by the rules. You know, people can negotiate and create different social relationships by choosing different forms of address, for example. And then, as I mentioned, in professional settings, traditionally, it is really common to use a surname plus address term, such as san and so on, but also position terms, such as shacho, executive, or kacho, section manager, and things like that. So, for example, when I was a young PhD student at a university in New South Wales, we had a visiting scholar, fairly well-established professor from Japan. So when we talked amongst our Australian colleagues who are native speakers of English, we would just address each other using our first names. But it was just such a huge gap when we were on our own speaking in Japanese. She would use my given name plus son, and then I would use her surname plus sensei, which is professor. So there was a huge gap in terms of the social meanings that we were producing with the choice of our address terms. One day, she ended up suggesting to me, look, Ikuko, let's just stop this. So you can just use my given name and son. Let's just settle on that so that we don't feel this huge gap between our mode of communication in English and in Japanese. And so, you know, that was a very interesting example that I actually often draw on when I teach social linguistics because, you know, it really shows how small things like, you know, address terms would mean a lot in terms of negotiating and creating human relationships.
Well, that really leads quite directly into my next question, which is when East Asian families migrate internationally, they often face pressure to adapt their naming practices. Ikuko, what strategies do people use to maintain cultural identity while navigating these new linguistic environments? And in diaspora communities particularly, do these naming practices preserve cultural identity at all across generations?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we all acknowledge that language and identity are really closely, you know, related, well, really tied together. Yeah, I think the choice you make in terms of how you address other people, how you refer to other people, and how you refer to yourself, how you introduce yourself, these things could, you know, these things do depend on context. Whether it is informal or formal, what you want to achieve in your social encounters. So, for example, we talk about all these transitions all the time, sorry. But for example, in my Japanese language class situation, I might say something like, okay, refer to my colleague as Professor somebody, Nani-nani-sensei, but then it's completely different in a more relaxed, informal situation that where you might actually switch to first name, san, again. So that is actually a very fluid thing, but it's also a lot to do with personal preferences in a sense that, you know, sometimes I feel like first names terms sit more comfortably, but other times it's not. it's quite challenging. I think also in terms of choosing, for example, people choose so-called Western names. So I do have, for example, in my case, I rarely use my so-called Western sounding name. but, you know, it is difficult to pronounce my name for non-Japanese speakers. So I often get, for example, Ikuko instead of Ikuko. So I just always, when I introduce myself, I just say, well, I for India. That's how you go with Ikuko, and that would make it probably easier for people to learn to pronounce my name. But I think in terms of choosing so-called Western names, I think there are lots of reasons. One is for practicality, so that, you know, it is easier for people who are not familiar with, say, Japanese names to pronounce my name. But, you know, also names are one of the first points of entry into conversation. So that means that it's really quite important that people learn your name quickly. And then that means that you're also easier to be integrated into conversation. I think, you know, for practical reasons, that's quite important. In my case, one of the most important situations where I might use my so-called Western name is when I buy takeaway coffees. So people ask your name, and I just don't want to spend 5 minutes giving a tutorial about my name. So, you know, in that kind of instance, it's purely a pragmatic choice. In some cases, there might be also cases where people might for example, people who went to Catholic schools in Asia, where it was more kind of like common to choose a Christian name. So that's another reason that people might choose anglicized names as well. But, you know, sometimes it's out of necessity and practicality. And then I also, for example, acknowledge the fact that I find it really quite difficult to learn names, European names, for example. And then I make mistakes. I also make spelling mistakes for names such as, for example, a Claire with an I or without an I, or Anne with E or without E. So, you know, these things do happen across the board. And I think the main thing is basically, well, you could persist and try and learn it so that you can, you know, you can do it appropriately. But then I think at the same time, it's really, you know, when you think about the social significance of name usage, especially in social interaction, I think it's really quite important that you show your goodwill. That is really my principle, I think, when it comes to names. But I also do try and make it easy for people, say in Australian context, to learn or pronounce my name. So, for example, my email sign-off has got a little embedded pronunciation tool, so that people can actually click on this pronounce word in my email sign-off so that they can hear me pronouncing my name. So there are all these, you know, new technologies that we can use so that we can familiarize ourselves in super diverse context.
You're listening to Ear to Asia from Asia Institute at the University of Melbourne. And just a reminder to listeners about Asia Institute's online publication on Asia and its societies, politics and cultures. It's called the Melbourne Asia Review. It's free to read and it's open access at melbourneasiareview.edu.au. You'll find articles by some of our regular Ear to Asia guests and by many others. Plus, you can catch recent episodes of Ear to Asia at the Melbourne Asia Review website, which again you can find at melbourneasiareview.edu.au. I'm Sammy Shah, and I'm joined by Asia historian Dr. Lewis Mayo and language scholar Professor Ikuko Nakane. We're talking about navigating East Asian names in a Western world. Lewis, let's look at one of the biggest linguistic hurdles that can lead to regular mispronunciations, tones. Chinese names, as well as those from Vietnam and a host of other countries, often involve tonal pronunciation that can completely change meaning. Is it realistic to expect native English speakers to master these distinctions, or is close enough actually good enough?
So tones are differences between words, right? In the same way that we might distinguish between cat and cap, based on the difference between the t and the p at the end of them. In Thai or in Chinese or in Vietnamese, you would distinguish between, you know, li and li. And those are different words. Those are not differences in pronunciation. I would say it's unlikely that tone will be a feature for English speakers of English speakers engaged with Chinese names without having to, if they haven't actually undertaken the business of studying Chinese, for the very simple reason that in Korea or in Japan, Chinese words are used without tones. So there is no tone distinction marked by a Korean who's using, and maybe something like 60% of Korean words are of Chinese origin. So the historical principle is that if your language is not tonal and you borrow words from a tonal language into that language, you'll probably ignore the tone. I think the issue for English speakers in relationship to Chinese names in the present, the most significant question is really the pronunciation of letters that are recognizable in English but have different sound values in Chinese. I mean, a good example of that is Xi of Xi Jinping, right? You'll often hear that as Xi because people look at the X and think that's an unfamiliar word, so I'll give it what I call the soup du jour treatment, which is that any word for an English speaker that is, or any letter that doesn't look like it has, it will be functioning as it does in English, gets pronounced like French je. So you'll hear people saying Xi Jinping for Xi Jinping. Now, in fact, that je sound doesn't exist in Chinese. So you'll find a lot of people referring to Beijing as Beijing, and you'll find even native speakers of Chinese now using that Beijing pronunciation, even though that's just the jing of jingle bells. That's a sound that we have in English. So Beijing is, it's like jingle bells, right? The jing of jingle bells. But you'll even find, because that pronunciation is so common, you'll find Chinese people using Beijing when speaking in English, which I must confess I find very strange. So there's the main issue, as I would say, are those letters in the romanized form of Chinese, such as X, Q, and J, and ZH, that don't have that represent sounds that we may or may not have in English. And then those tend to be reworked by people who are used to having their name rendered by native English speakers according to what an English speaker assumes the name is. So, for instance, the Chinese name Shi, S-H-I, is often rendered in English as Shi. So that, you can imagine, so S-H-I, you want to think of the I has two values in that Chinese romanization system. There's the E sound, like Xi as in Xi Jinping, and then there's an U sound, which you could imagine it being written I-H. So if someone's name is S-H-I, it's Shi. If their name is X-I, it's Xi. So it's E and U. So two different values.
So that romanization of Chinese that you're describing, is that the pinyin system?
That's the pinyin system, which has been used since really the 1970s in most renderings of Chinese names from the People's Republic of China.
Is that helpful or is it a hindrance?
Well, it's a fantastic system. It's an incredibly, if you know the rules, you have no trouble reading out a Chinese name that you see written down. It's a really, really clear and very, very well formulated system for producing a Chinese and Romanized form. The problem arises when people don't know what the rules are and simply apply a guess based on what the letter might stand for in English. So it's, if you think about that X letter, that letter doesn't have a sh value in English, but it does in Portuguese. So if you think of Xanana Guzmão, X-A-N-A, the former president of Timor-Leste, he's got an X at the beginning of his name. So that surprises people. So I don't know if people here are familiar with the pop singer Baby Rexha. She's often called B-B-B-E-B-E-R-E-X-A-H-A of Albanian background. That name is actually Resha. So that X is like pronounced like the sh in Xi Jinping or the sh in Xanana Guzmão that you can find in Chinese or in Portuguese. But because we have X as box or as h, we don't generally think of that sh sound as one that will go with that letter. So that's the problem. It's just not knowing what sound that letter designates in the language that it's used to romanize.
Different transliteration systems do create chaos in official records. The same Chinese name might appear as Li or Li or Li as in L-E-E, depending on the system used. How do these inconsistencies create real-world problems for people navigating bureaucracy then?
Oh, I don't think they create problems at all. It's just as simply, well, my name is Li, L-E-E, my name is Li, L-I. And it's whatever you have written down. The fact that they may be two names of common origin, but often the L-E-E pronunciation, which is used in Korean or in Cantonese, right, is something that's well established. And it's, of course, always convenient because it's exactly the same as the English surname Li. Therefore, one would make an assumption that if someone's name is L.I. Lee, they're probably someone whose rendering of that name is associated, it's likely, with Mandarin and two of its modern transliteration systems. But no, I don't think it particularly causes problems. It's just a matter of how the name is said and how it's written.
Ikuko, employment research shows that resumes or CVs with Anglo-Saxon names are significantly more likely to get interview callbacks than those with Chinese, Japanese, Indian, or any other South Asian or East Asian names. How do administrative biases around names perpetuate workplace discrimination?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, just as you said, you know, there is bias, I think, you know, often based on the names. I think we need more education. And then also, another interesting research finding is that diversity actually creates a better workplace. And also diversity is good for, diversity brings positive outcomes for your work. So I think, you know, there needs to be a lot more recognition that the rich workplace culture, that different names and people from various cultural backgrounds come together to create a really productive, creative, and resilient workplace. I think there needs to be more recognition, and then also voices of people who have experienced that need to be heard, so that all these misconceptions and bias can be addressed.
Well, that then goes directly into my next question, which is what specific strategies, tools, or resources have you found effective for helping Westerners learn East Asian names correctly, for example, phonetic guides or, you know, the audio resources that we've heard about, things like Name Coach, etc. Are they effective?
Well, I think they're effective, but then we also have to find time. We need to find time and commitment of the people who you work with, also teachers working with students from various backgrounds. I myself find it really sometimes really hard to make sure that I can pronounce the students' names correctly. So, you know, I think we need to create opportunities and then also, yeah, share all these resources that that are now available to us. So that's really good. The other thing is that, okay, also, in a way, we can start with addressing some myths about names. So we need to take a more global view about what names, how names work in different languages and cultures, traditions. So for example, there are places where people might have one name and the workplace system may not be actually compatible. So in a way, our administration systems at our workplaces could be modified so that we can actually be more inclusive in the way that we operate within our organizations as well. And then also, bringing a more inclusive cultural practices when it comes to names.
Lewis, looking to the future then, how optimistic are you that Western academic institutions can become more inclusive in their approach to diverse names, and what needs to happen right away to make that vision a reality?
I'm not a fan of the category of Western. I don't particularly find that a useful one.
I agree.
Where we might ask about that question is, as Australian society pluralizes in terms of the groups within our population structure, will it become more like Singapore? Now, Singapore is probably a place where you would find a very high, probably the place on earth where you would find perhaps the highest degree of awareness of diversity in naming practices, because the society has, you know, got a lot of people of Chinese background, a lot of people who are of South Asian background, Southeast Asians, and people with name systems that are derived from the Islamic world. And so people there are just used to that because they're used to a multicultural educational and social environments. And you learn that stuff basically from your school friends. So if your school is diverse in terms of its linguistic profile, you'll probably grow up with a lot of flexibility in relation to names. Like, for, you know, I went to a school where Japanese was taught, even though I didn't study it myself. So I've been hearing Japanese names my entire life. I was interested in issues to do with Chinese culture. So, you know, I have there's no issue for me in relationship to Chinese surnames. I can't ever remember not understanding that Chinese surnames came first and given names came second. So that's just simply a matter of the kind of environment that you grow up with. When I moved to China, of course, you know, there was the question of what was I going to be called? This is rather funny because my surname, Mayo, sounds remarkably similar to the Chinese word for no or not. So the joke goes, if it's Nishinksuma, what's your surname? My reconscripting Mayo, which literally sounds like I don't have a surname. So this is something that caused a lot of amusement over the year. So initially, because of course the Chinese bureaucratic system had to assign Chinese characters to my name, I think I was originally Ma Yue Lu Yi Si, something like that, based on how they thought I was. So, but I selected a Chinese name, so I have a Chinese name, Liu Yi, so the surname Liu and the first given name Yi. And so in those contexts, for a lot of Chinese people, that's much easier than trying to work out how my name should be rendered, either in Chinese characters to sort of approximate the syllables of the English name and given name, or else trying to manage what they think it will be based on how it looks written down. Now, of course, you know, the challenges to anyone coming into a naming system that is not one that they've grown up with are substantial. I mean, for someone whose educational background is Chinese, the surname systems in Australia for people of Europhone backgrounds are really challenging. Now, there are going to be all kinds of features of the way that names are written that are not how they are pronounced. And this, of course, will vary from within English systems themselves. You know, so for instance, the name McMahon, you know, is McMahon in Australia and McMahon in Jamaica. So, you know, those are, or I suppose it's like the difference between Berkeley, California, and Bishop Berkeley, after whom it was named. Those things are going to vary a lot, and they're going to be challenging with every system that you look at. Think about how much trouble most of us who are not Irish have with trying to work out how Irish names are said when we see them written down. So, you know, it's only in, you know, people like Saoirse Ronan have become, you know, kind of famous, or Sinéad O'Connor. Only when those people become famous do people begin to manage those names. So coming back to your question, I suspect that the tendency will be to alter East Asian names according to the Ikukon Nakane principle, i.e. to start with the given name and have the surname last. I think that's highly likely to be the tendency that we'll have in the future. I don't think Xi Jinping will become Jinping Xi anytime soon. But most students at the University of Melbourne or other universities in Australia of Chinese background are used to the idea that their given name comes first and their surname comes second, which I find really weird. But nonetheless, that's in a sense how people are used to that. Jackie Chan and Bruce Lee, you know, the two most famous Chinese background actors of the 20th century, both had English given names, which were quite different from the names that they had in Cantonese, which were, in the case of Jackie Chan, a pseudonym, and indeed of Bruce Lee as well. So people adopt often stage names and things like that. So my sense is that if we look at K-pop stars as an indication of people from East Asian surname, particularly Korean background cultures, becoming globally famous, the tendency seems to me to be, you know, for Roseanne Park, you know, to have an English given name and then a Korean surname, or for them to be mononymous, like a lot of the members of BTS. You know, they will just have one name by which they are known, and so I suspect that will be a tendency that will probably persist in the present. The other thing, of course, is for a lot of people in East Asia, having a given name that is English or European is kind of prestigious. You know, being able to call yourself Jenny or something like that is a sign that you are not confined to just one cultural world.
If I may jump in, there's two things going on that, you know, that might be quite interesting. One is that because of the globalization, maybe, that a lot of, in a way, outward-looking families might actually say, like in Japan, they might actually try and give their children names that could work both in the Anglo world as well as in the context of Japan. So, for example, a given name like Hana, that could work in English as well as in Japanese. And then you can actually attribute a beautiful Chinese character to it. So, you know, that's one thing. The other thing is that officially also, you know, for example, Japanese government, they actually issued a statement that in official documents, where Japanese names need to be represented in romanization, we actually adopt family name first, and then given name order, which is in a way unconventional in modern Japan. So there is a new push against the so-called Western norm happening at official spaces as well.
Well, that then brings me to you, Ikuko, finally to wrap things up. Looking at the future, the same question as I asked Lewis, looking at the future, how optimistic are you that these Western academic institutions can become more inclusive, and what needs to happen to make that a reality?
I think we can be very positive about it. I think we talk more about diversity and inclusion in our workplaces, in in general, more often. And I think, you know, well, you know, look, we managed to talk for an hour about names and, you know, we should talk about it more and actually celebrate diversity because it's fascinating, isn't it? So in a way, it's enriching. And I think we need to feel positive about talking about and discovering and embracing diversity and find joy in learning about different traditions. And I think the other thing that we need to recognize is that, as I gave in my example of names that would work across cultures, for example, there's a lot of like hybridity that we observe in a contemporary globalized world. So, I guess we should also, you know, embrace that kind of hybridity. And then also, you know, the fact that we are a product of all our experiences and our, you know, the social domains in which we actually live and then work in. So in that environment, you know, we can enjoy living in the world we live in now and then learn from each other.
So I'd like to raise the naming practices cultural change in my own country of Aotearoa, New Zealand, that you now find amongst young people of Māori and of Pacific Island descent. It's very, very common for people to have Māori names that would, in my generation, 40, 50 years ago, would have been considered too difficult for non-Māori people to engage with. But, and so people have names that are proudly marking their Māoriness. So that's an example of a society that I think has been able to shift from quite conservative views of name culture, in which the dominant, you know, so-called mainstream, which is a Pākehā white Anglo-Celtic cultural system, was considered to be the standard setter for the rest of the population, to one in which something else has now emerged. And I would say that this is something that younger people, by and large, you know, enjoy. And so that's a sign, I guess, of how at particular historical and cultural junctures, you can find things moving in unexpected directions. So there's a complex of, I think, different currents at play here. On the one hand, there is the tendency, as Ikuko mentioned, for, cosmopolitan or outward-looking Japanese people to choose names that are phonetically simple, you know, such as, you know, the hana, as you said, or names that are easily pronounced by people from outside of the Japanese cultural word, like Naomi, which also happens, of course, to be a Hebrew word, and that people who are mindful, parents who are mindful of the problems that a name might produce, you know, if your name is Keisuke, K-E-I-S-U-K-E, in Romanized Japanese, the problems that that kind of name might produce for the person who has it when they're outside of Japan might lead Japanese parents to choose a name that's phonetically less challenging. And I would certainly think that, you know, if one is choosing a name for a child who, you know, is from an Anglo-Celtic family, you might want to avoid sounds that are difficult to pronounce for people who don't come from those systems. So, you know, if your name was Theo, for example, there are a lot of languages in which the th sound is not pronounceable. So you might want to say, okay, I might find it easier to name my child Dan, because Dan is a fairly set of sounds that, you know, it's a sound combination that's relatively easy to produce in a lot of different kind of contexts. So parents will have, you know, their own decisions to make about naming for their children and how to balance up all of these different considerations. So I see the historical tendencies as quite diverse in terms of what might happen in the future. We might end up like Singapore with people who are extremely name flexible and, in a sense, multi-skilled, multi-talented when it comes to naming. Or we might find name reassertion, such as the case I mentioned in New Zealand, where people are saying, no, I'm going to have a name that is as Māori as it can sound, and it's going to be pronounced properly in a Māori way. And if you get it wrong, I'm going to tell you that you got it wrong. Or you might have a situation, in a sense, where people are moving towards a kind of simplification for convenience. So, three scenarios.
On that note, our guests have been Professor Ikuko Nakane and Dr. Lewis Mayo, both of Asia Institute at the University of Melbourne. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ear to Asia is brought to you by Asia Institute. You can find more information about this and all our other episodes at the Asia Institute website. Be sure to keep up with every episode of Ear to Asia by following us on the Apple Podcasts app, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you like the show, please rate and review it. Every positive review helps new listeners find the show. And please help us by spreading the word on your socials. This episode was recorded on the 24th of September 2025. Producers were Eric Van Bemmel and Kelvin Param of Profactual.com. Ear to Asia is licensed under Creative Commons Copyright 2025, the University of Melbourne. I'm Sammy Shah. Thanks for your company.